standard of fuel, what kind of fuels are used for lighting, conditioning, for cooking, access to water, sanitation, what type of bearings, including self-treatment and access on access. So, in relation to climate change, what we use as fuel impacts the climate. And then, of course, the legal one is environmental. So, there are those dimensions, four dimensions, and some dimensions for the economic.
Now,
the storyline in South Africa is the tier one, 2001 and 2011 poverty, we have been affected, the millennium government poverty at half, or reduced dramatically from about an average of 18 headcounts to about 8. Now, the question that we haven't answered adequately is what was the driver of that? We know there are grants, there's housing, there are feeding systems, and so on, but what one needs to know is what is the key driver of that? Because in terms of choosing what strategy, you actually need to know what are your key drivers. And those key drivers, you can drive them simultaneously at times in each gender for maximum impact. And that's what one would like to write from. So we are taking the room, a very deliberate, because the key question that we find as proposed in South Africa is we share the cost. Roads were the key things that we're supposed to drive down. And one has to look at what has happened in those roads. So we take the cost. If you go to the city manager now and talk about the load, you know that city manager remember what that load was for. So that's really something. And now, unfortunately, I look like a priest here reading the Bible. There is the congregation not reading the Bible, so I can read anything. That was the only section we read the Bible at the priest, and the congregation wrote.
No copy.
So you manage. So if we look at the multidimensional poverty headcount in South Africa for rural roads, and here we are being comparing South Africa as a whole, rural South Africa, rural roads, and the individual roads themselves. So I hope what I see here I can actually articulate in ways that I can imagine it and visualize it. So on the whole, if you look at South Africa, poverty by 2001 was at 18.2%, and that is the and that has been reduced to 8%. So that's the headcount, and that is at almost $1.25. That is that figure of time it was reduced from Africa. For rural South Africa, it was 9.1% being reduced to 14.2%. And the rural loans were 9.9 and 22.2. The first question is that is happening. Is there a difference between 9.9 and 29.1? Which is the baseline of poverty in South Africa. When you look at South Africa in rural areas, generally, it was 9.1. When you look at the rural loans, it was 9.1. Now, and then it was reduced to 14.6 and 14.2. Now the key question is, was there need to name anything in the world? Because the poverty there are certain things. So that's a key policy question. How do you determine that A is an old disease? Obviously there were problems of was there adequate data at the time when you know the time there was no data at the time. There was no capacity to process the information in a way that would be there for the teachers in life. So, when we try to understand how the node strategy works, we have to understand what was the context and how it was driven, and whether we can go to a municipality now. Any manager will explain like anything about the node. Which asks the left the question, are we staying the cost? On a matter that which requires that we have to stay the cost. However, when you look at the nodes that were selected, like calculus, you know, central carbon, carbon footprint, and so on. They perform differential. But the key question there is how do they deliver that makes this low perform differential? So those questions are the questions that we ask. And when you look at the reduction, for instance, the reduction in poverty ranges from reducing it by 56% to reducing it totally by 50%. Carbon footprint analysis is the theme in terms of how poverty is reduced. And when you look at carbon footprint analysis at the moment, when you look at that, is the center of that in South Africa. And largely because of the HIV, if you get to the causes of death, they are largely parasitic in HIV and AIDS and HIV. That's what kills the income. And when you look at the apartheid strategy of putting people in those spaces, and then you look at the road from housing and the T-states to convert that state, the track of convention. So, no brainer that we have created a situation where, as a country, in those years, has actually created a situation where disease, very trigger, you set a bonfire. It's like the father says, check that out. Put a little bit of parasite over the weekend, and they have it over. You know that that check that meant to do that. And that's what they're saying. So I think that what we are trying to elicit here is a differentiated strategy of understanding the locality, the cocktail of things that are creating the different factors. I think that's what we are trying to do. Now, when you look at the nodes excluding rural nodes. And I said that rural is when you look at the nodes generally, they are, when you look at South Africa rural, it's almost the same as when you exclude the nodes, you actually see the difference. And the difference here is between rural South Africa, which is farming community. But in farming communities, also poverty is extreme, but in the farmer is rich. So you find that your the wealth of the farmer and the poverty of the worker, and then we get a better indicator for us. And then when you take rural nodes themselves, you see that extreme poverty. So that makes it really crucial. So now, and when we look at the reduction in poverty there also over a period of time for rural South Africa, it's no separate from South Africa rural general. You see a big reduction in poverty. Now, what are the drivers of poverty? They are well known. Although living conditions have improved, that is electricity, sanitation, water, etc. If you have one, this accounted for 49.7% of the drivers of poverty. By 2011, they are 5%. Unemployment was 5%. So, unless you settle unemployment, while forces of poverty were largely living conditions in 2001. Those have been dealt with, and we see a reduction of 5% points. But here we see unemployment coming to 10% points from 25% to 35%. So that's a biggest driver of poverty and swelling. Education, we look at education as how many years of schooling and children in school, that has reduced as a driver of poverty from 23% to 23%. Now, coming to urban areas, there's a very interesting urban node map. Urban node competing for a teacher in that time. Eden South Africa, 11.95%, and then Eden Loop, poverty from 3.4%. And then, of course, the most significant investment in reducing poverty was in from 6.9 to 8.5%. That was the biggest move one to see. Although, we can say, if we look at Richard Slade, you know, we just compare the numbers, and we can just say that was where the greatest movement was, because it was from 11.5 to 26%. But, it's a matter of statistics there. But 10.9 in Uganda, which was very high, to what was the significant move. Now, what is very interesting is, when we now look at 7 South Africa and exclude the load, you see a similar story of how do we choose to do. There is not much difference excluding the 7 South Africa and excluding the load. There is not much difference. So what was the basis for that? So I think the key message is that the policy position for choosing the loan appears to have been uninformed. I think the choices that were made then didn't have adequate information to say what the cycle should be. If you have told them everything, in fact, the way poverty was reduced in South Africa was reduced the same way, both in loans and non-loans, in the poverty seeking area. So suggesting that the loaner strategy was just inaugurating something without. But then the key question I think that comes is that did he pay the cost in those loans? And I doubt he did. I think he might go to the study now. I think that's really the key message. Now, we have some data, and based on the data, we can target them. Because previously, really, there wasn't enough data. In 2002, when the loan was declared, the census of 2001 had not been caught. So it would be irresponsible to suggest that the choices were ill-informed. The choices were informed with good intentions, but there was positive things. But now we have the data. And in this data for 2011 headcount, we have listed the poorest municipalities, and if we have to target, then we can look at those poorest. The question still remains as to whether we can say we stay the cost, and whether the cost figure of things that our children actually do what it is. More generally, I think social sciences play a major role of figuring out things. So, what we have said, South Africa, we have just said, we are paying out sciences, we don't need to mention any names, we go with a straight down approach as the social sciences as a key driver for us. That we don't know also that it's not sustainable because the systems are not. So there is a typical thing that we might say using that kind of thing. So better targets in all those things are now critical. So why is it since 2001 and 2011 poverty was reduced drastically? But there are still areas that are still vulnerable, like Alfred Joe, Zimiati, Uga Sambo, Kanya Kuze. Buffalo City, and there are about 20 of those. Then we try to look at capital expenditure, what has happened there, how has it changed since 2006 and 2011. We'll try and look at trend line on that across time and say the capital expenditure actually contributes to that forward for individual and social benefits. We need to differentiate what those poverty down.
Now,
having done that, then what we wanted to look at is how does the demographic landscape change over time in South Africa? And I'll go very quickly over this. Between 2001 and 2011, and by what magnitude the population has grown between those points in time. And you see that from the city of Johannesburg added 1.2 million people from 2001 to 2011. That is, you put all Northern Cape citizens and put them in country. That is Johannesburg. That's the kind of money that you have. All the people in Northern Cape, all people in Swaziland and added them in Johannesburg. If you look at the city of Cape Town, 827,000 from 2.8 to 2.7. That was the significant growth of people, city of Swaziland. So, urbanization is quite a reality. And if we take the lowest, the lowest population ordered in that fashion, Nkuma in Eastern Cape lost about 1,000, and Mbabane about 7,559 people in that region. So urbanization is a reality. Let me can look at this in terms of war. War is unfortunately the wars don't have names. And when they don't have names, they have relationship. And I don't know how political where it stands. I can be linked to myself as by name, but by number, only by house number I can go that number. So if you take what six 9470206, six person can get it for the number one. So those were lost people. 10,335 award 12 and 3,190 So in between the time all those wars lost a good number of people. So at the world level, they data that is available, which wars gained and which wars lost. For instance, world 118 gained 34,600. So now, if there is a world counselor that takes in that world, if he has not provided enough toilets and water and sanitation and everything, and that world must be saved, taking on board so many other people, because we are harmonizing. What we are seeing here is not a result of constituency boundaries and the Zeramandari, but we have harmonized the boundaries in 2001 and brought them back and see real growth. So I think that when we look at this in terms of war, it's a clearer political management strategy for that. So now the map here will show how those chemical toilets at what level, water, sanitation, electricity, and so on. So I think that, well, there's also, I think that in terms of population structure, there has been an age shift in the composition of the population. Not because more children are born, because the age group 5 to 15, actually possibly 5 to 19, could have migrated and then within the growth of our population. What are the conclusions that we can see? For example, Central Karoo. In Central Karoo, what we found is that all indigenous now know that the CDC was in 2011, but 90% and 50% was effectively receiving sanitation and solid waste. Buffalo City was not classified as a no-hit, but already started Indian Buffalo Territory about 4 years ago. So the Villa of Texas is facing that the land and the Ocean Rules in Laguna South was not a no-hit, however, has performed better than some areas classified as no-hit, such as India and Michigan. Then they in Poco not classified as a no-hit, however, has more coverage of so the key issue here is how does the policy state prioritize? And then prioritize how does it follow to ensure that validates actually prioritize is being implemented. I think we have enough data now to actually start the way much better than we did earlier. So I say that I've not dealt with climate change in the subject, and not that it's not important. We are doing it for the national account. And we are, it's something that we have to look at as a macro scale, as climate change, but pollution more as a micro scale, because it's a matter that you know that there's much more pollution in the power, there's much more pollution. But those are things that we are doing at the level of an internal account. Given that the measurement issues now do not only include labor and man-made capital, but natural capital, this will be an important aspect of measurement. Because natural capital, our lakes, our waters, our preserved areas, how are we preserving them, the mining, the competitive mining and preserving the environment and all that, the use of food, all those aspects, but the future measurement is taking into account natural capital, not only the capital like standard and that, the construction, and labor. Bringing those three things into the equation, the third stage is the natural capital. Makes the field of measurement and the field of policy making quite interesting.
Thank you very much, Statistician General, for the presentation. And of course, you couldn't see it there. Yeah. It's always exciting when you see it moving there. Okay, but there is another team that's supposed to make a presentation and we have a discussion. I don't think there's South African Cities Network. Oh, you are around? Okay. Okay, we will invite you when you are ready.
On this spreadsheet there, the words are the document that I was talking to in terms of changes, in terms of what was, what the province is expressing, that is the province, that is but we do that and we have a name for the world.
The Statistician General Award. Because you have to name it using all animals that are available. And penguins and a flag of naming award, Mthubu. Mthubu. It would be difficult. I don't think you can win. Okay.
While we're waiting, can we ask questions?
Okay. Pause the question. Jethro? Malaham?
No, sir. Maybe if it's a pity that some of these awards don't have names, and if you can be guided how to judge the formula to understand, because particularly on one of your slides where there's a decrease in the award level, I'm looking at one of those awards in it lost more than 44,000. And it's what 5220501 121. get that word, because that such information is quite important. And if you may get some details, maybe to analyze which area is it and what was happening, so that one can try to analyze the impact, what was going on here, especially in this word. And
it was an earthquake.
Yeah, that we were not aware of. So, you know, that's what the people of data sometimes tell you. So this data must indicate to us. And yeah, that's the only one that I needed to know, Chair. Maybe if you can follow the similar on the other ones, if you can get the name, the fix that we did not see the white cop. So the Bicop would have shown the area and the water. Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I have three questions.
Yes.
The first is, with regard to the first page of the spreadsheet, the increases in population at municipal level, and actually more to the point, the decreases in population at municipal level on the second page. Chair, I'm curious to know whether the Statistician General is consulted during the categorization process for municipalities, whether the MDB and the departments consult with the Statistician General to see these migration patterns. The example that I want to use is on the second page, about halfway down, GT484, Mirapong. Now, that's just been proposed that be included in a metro area in Gauteng. And it strikes me that it's an area that is losing people. It's not an area of high growth. So why would we then be incorporating it into a proposed metro area? So I'd be interested to know if there's that level of consultation taking place. We heard from the MDE the other day that these are facts that they consider. The second question, Chair, is similar to what Honourable Ndau asked, asked about the ward. And it goes to the increases, not so much the decreases. And that is, I don't know of any wards that have got 90,000 people in it. I could be wrong here. I mean, look, when we talk about wards, we talk about the voters. And I think the biggest wards are about 15 to 20,000 voters, registered voters. But I don't know any that have 90,000 people in it. So my question then is the ward, or have the ward boundaries, which change every 5 years, more or less, okay, have those changes been factored in when we're looking at the population statistics here, the migration statistics? In other words, are we looking at the same ward, the same boundaries in 2011 as we were in 2001?
What I would just please. Chairperson and members of the committee, thank you very much. I'd like to thank the Statistician General for the usual giving a very interesting input. What I would though ask is that maybe if the Statistician General could be invited back to the committee, time permitting, hopefully also when technology is in a better mood, but maybe then also to drill down on some of these things. I would agree that I think some of these ward statistics deserve further interrogation. Clearly, I mean, the guidelines that the MDB and the IEC work on, I mean, would not permit any award of this size legally. So I think the question then arises is, as Milam has asked, are we comparing ward apples with ward apples, or ward apples with ward watermelons? But secondly, also, is to say that
you could have demarcated a ward of 20,000 and then had a very rapid increase in population, maybe an informal settlement or some other development that would then have spiked the population. So I think those things would be interesting to go into. So my other question would be that if one looks at the Statistician General's presentation superficially, it would suggest that almost the exclusive driver of the growth of urban areas is migration. And I think migration is an important part, but my question to the Statistician General would be, to what extent have many of our urban areas assumed a growth dynamic of their own, where that growth is now being propelled from within the city? Of course, the two tendencies are not by any means exclusive. Last is, I've on previous occasions, I've seen presentations by the Statistician General that talk to issues of the nature of our space, and especially the racialized nature of space in South Africa. I think it would be interesting to have that presentation as well.
Thank you very much. On with my son.
Thank you very much. The word that I said, the business numbers that the lobby have made. But I think largely what has happened here is when you look at the boundaries of being together, there has been a lot of movement of people into those walls. And I think that the current process of re-demarcation, we have applied to defend so that there is a world of reasonable class. The need for consultation between ourselves and the demarcation board in order to for them to arrive at a reasonable decision as to what qualifies for a municipality or a metro and the like. and you have a consultant and you have tried to encourage them to get a number of factors which we have actually compiled and which we compiled. You know, and in 1996, I think, we did a central place in there. The land expense influence how our faith is organized. Obviously, we are sitting in Asia, but we can't influence the wrong thing. But looking at the economic state, it's almost an important aspect of what we need to do. We have done that exercise now again, currently. It may come a little bit late because I think that the mathematics involved has seen forward in the work. But the body of that work should be formed in the future demarcation. So, honorable members of the committee, yes, indeed, this number is a little bit too big for what, but what is the most important thing would be about a certain number, and then, of course, then we know who are not opposing it, would be about the. 20 or so percent of the, or 40% of the population. So it's quite conceivable to have a ward of, on average, about 50,000 people, but or 40,000 people. But as a consequence of migration, those wards are likely to have been crowded now. The growth dynamics in this place is on their own. There is that in certain areas is a little bit, if you look at fertility in other areas, because you either grow through migration, which is just locally, but or through the number of children that you have bought. And you know, the growth, the fertility rate in certain areas are very low. They are probably even below, they are almost at the same time. For a population to replace itself, and you need to have 2.1 share, on average, you might have to have 2.1 share. Then you know you are replacing. At the moment, we are at the country level, we are about 2.2. So we are 0.5 children, just about the same. What the problem is in the country, and you probably need to confront. Men are not taking the problem is of Africa is not about fertility. It's about how they share in their responsibility. If you take the population of South Africa, 50% of marriageable men say they are married. Again, 50% of women say they are married. And 50% say they are married. And it must be balanced by another 50% of women who say they are married. It's only 50% who say they are married. And this defines how the bringing up of children happens to school to that. And I think that's the biggest problem that we don't settle down. All these things are not going to help. We can throw money things that as long as we don't take care of bringing children out and the community of only women and the women are going to their feet. They cannot get it for us. And that then permeates how we organize our lives. I mean, marriage as an institution is very legal institution, so bad. But even when it is bringing up children to go to say they are free to go back, it's still an institution. Even if marriage is an institution and that's how. But in South Africa, men don't care about it. The children still need to serve their day. Because they don't ask whether your father is still alive. More than it's a good proportion of fathers are saved these days. I'm over by fast, paternal often is higher than that we have declared no claim here.
When they are
alive. They are ecologically dead, socially dead, only biologically alive. That's all. And that, I think, is what we
are that's very sad.
Yeah.
The Matole must speed up that the amendment must come up very soon. Those who don't support must be named and shamed. Matole must not waste time on this one. Statistician, you must call Matole here.
Only one number that was asked is Hindu.
Invite you again, and we promise you the system will be working. We'll test it for many months before you come. If it collapses, you must know that we have tried. The decision general must then tell us what is the problem. What is the problem? Okay. No, but it's a very important information is assisting us.
You need to download this presentation.
Okay.
I no longer trust my attaching this and email.
Okay, now thank you very much, Mr. General. I think it's very useful information. And I think we have captured many issues around poverty, reduction, the challenges. All that, I think, is very important, particularly for the committee and that is working on the cooperative governance, because it works to ensure that the entire governance works in a coordinated way. It seems a lot of challenges, and I think we're going to have some time again for us to have a real discussion about some of the issues. Hopefully, the demarcation board will be in touch with you from time to time. Because we take the point that it's possible to have 74,000 people in the ward, but the only 15,000 who are voting, the others are not voting, but are there in terms of the number and other things. It's possible to have that. It's just we don't go and fight with the demarcation board. There are 74 people, far better to say 74,000 voters. That we're talking about human voting there. And it's very important that we do that. Otherwise, we may end up fighting with them. And then, why this one, but the real issue, only 20,000 people could vote. The rest are underage, generally. But they are there, they are counted as human beings. It's just important that we note that. Okay. And it seems the social tension is very useful, as the decision general. But also, we are worried about the kids. That we may have no resources in future to support them unless the productive set of economy grows and employs a large number of people. We will take care of this and also take care of the issue that we raise around dead fathers. I just hope that we are not dead fathers ourselves. Impossible to be a dead father when you are alive, is true. Now I think we'll also take it to the team that is dealing with this matter. Emphasizing to much all the Justice Committee one. But they must speed up this and finalize it. And then because I think it causes more harm than good for society. It seems now it's working after we have presented the Statistician General. For whatever reason, the project was very angry with you. Very angry with you. There are numbers. Let us move on and have a presentation.
police from time to time, there's water, there's tea, there's everything. Whoever wants to take something to drink, please just feel at home. We'll do that. Yes, ma'am.
Oh. We are using the group number, the employment number, shortly, in the media center,
at about 10.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The pharmacy in Georgia. I think when we are going to sleep tonight, we'll be very happy.
I only know that I'm using the media
I thought it would be something Igleek. Thank you very much, Mr. General and the Chief. We will invite you surely to come back and have a discussion. There are a lot of issues that we are dealing with, the climate change problem, changes, all those issues. And we'll invite you also to come back. Thank you very much. Is it not working now?
Stevenson. Thank you very much, and greetings to the meeting. I apologize that I was late. I just missed some parts of the presentation that the Statistician General was making. I do assume, however, that I may be repetitive just in light of the fact that I missed parts of his presentation. I am going to try to be quite quick. The presentation was compiled between ourselves in the Cities Network, the CSIR, and the University of Pretoria. So we were all three supposed to be here. Just on a general note, I think we know our population, and I think we can now confirm the rate at which urbanization is taking place, and that is the fact that most South Africans live in areas that could be called urban areas. So urbanization, I think as the Statistician General was saying, is our reality and something that we need to manage. Then the second matter that characterizes our cities in particular is the big gap that is existing, the big income gap between various households.
Is it 70%?
60. Oh, sorry. So I thought you're talking about the urbanization. Okay, but it's huge and it continues to increase. I think that's the most important point. Then cities, in particular in metropolitan areas, are the ones that have been experiencing the highest population growth during that period between 1996 and 2011, and the highest growth of urban town population was actually experienced during that particular time, 1996 to 2011. But notwithstanding, whilst the average population growth for the country is at 1.85%, for cities and towns, we have seen that it is above average, hovering around 2.8% during that very same period. So in other words, people are moving into urban spaces as much as they possibly can. Of course, our understanding is that they are in search of a better life, and there is a notion that a better life is more prevalent in those particular areas. This map speaks to indicate where the population increase has been. So you can see Gauteng, the Western Cape in particular, some parts of Nelson Mandela, Mangaung at the very center, and parts of KwaZulu-Natal, just relative to the entire country. This one. Okay. So the red spikes on the map are the ones that are indicating where the population is moving to, and it's second. So it's got the highest population growth. So metropolitan areas have an average growth rate of just more than 3%. Big towns or your secondary municipalities are standing at just under 3%. In the metropolitan municipalities, Gauteng and the Cape Town functional area are the ones that have experienced most. So it's not just the city of Cape Town or the municipality, but the broader functional area that we could refer to as in Cape Town. Secondary municipalities have also been experiencing growth rates in population as well. Of course, not to the extent that the metropolitan municipalities have been doing. This map seeks to compare growth rates between cities and towns, so it's not just municipalities, but it's beginning to reflect on what has been happening in the country generally, and it's quite readable and understandable in that particular way. Here are some of the things that we have observed, Chair. The fact that there's a misperception that urbanization is a problem of rural urban migration, and we think that it's not necessarily the case. Some of the migration is happening insular within the area, the metropolitan areas themselves. Secondly, and I think we've been saying this for quite some time now, that poverty is no longer a rural issue. It is in fact an urban phenomenon. So activists are beginning to call it the urbanization of poverty, or in other words, that poverty has urbanized as well. Whilst migration to and from metros is most significant, there are also other major trends. The movement from smaller towns and areas of decline to bigger towns, which are promising. The loss seems to also be from areas of economic decline to big rural areas, as it were. Further, there's a highly mobile population, predominantly very, very young. In accordance to perceptions by young work seekers attracted by the bright life in metropolitan areas, and they want to explore opportunities there. So the bulk of the population that is in mobility, moving from one area to the other, is quite a young population. Here we seek to indicate where the bulk, which of the provinces have made a net gain and which ones have made a net loss. The yellow indicative of those that have received population, so the Western Cape, the Northwest and Gauteng, which means all other populations are generally losing their population. Of course, KZN being the least of the losers in terms of the population, still having the ability to retain their population. Some places attract people and some places lose people. Places that have gained most people through movement are areas where diversity and there's a range of opportunities are best seen. Evidently, it's metropolitan municipalities and cities. Also areas where opportunities are likely to arise, where there's new investment, which is why you see the likes of your Nelson Mandela Bay also having some rate or level of population increase as a result of, for instance, projects such as Kuka. And of course, where there are newly found natural resources that lead to mining of those natural resources, we will see a population increase, which basically indicates that people move to specific places in search of jobs, I think primarily. I think that's the most important thing to take out of here. This slide is basically indicating, and I think it's a better depiction of the slide that I indicated earlier. As you can see, Cape Town, George, some parts of Nelson Mandela have a lot of in-migration and housing as it were them. And then there are the top 20. I think I did see a slide that the statistics in general, and this is also a reputation. So you can see the city of Tswana is leading in terms of its population, net population in migration, and it's an issue. And obviously, there it could also have been the redemarcation that just recently took place, which makes the city of Cape Town a net gainer. Places that lose people are places that have, a major economic decline, highly concentrated towns, especially in the homeland areas in Limpopo. Those are the people, those are the places or provinces that have lost people through movement. National trends at an inter-municipal level, population movement index between various municipalities, the blue being indicative of how it is that those municipalities are receiving a population. Net out migration, Mpuleni, Bay of Buffalo City, those are the municipalities that are losing people to other places or to other provinces. Movement between places in South Africa, from when to where did people move between 2001? Biggest movement happens between the big cities. Significant movement trends also from Eastern Cape to the Western Cape, from the Northwest to Limpopo and then to Gauteng, from the Free State to the Western Cape, Gauteng and Mpumalanga, and from smaller towns to bigger towns and cities. And I think those are the trends which are depicted in this slide, essentially indicating how population movement is taking place between various towns and cities. This is quite a loaded slide. We could spend a lot of time trying to unpack here. For instance, the population movement from areas such as your Port St. John to Nuka, or the city of Tshwane to the city of Cape Town. That's what this depiction is attempting to do here. Okay, then the biggest flows directions between cities, I think we can see the movement between Gauteng and the Western Cape, the movement between the Western Cape and the Eastern Cape, some parts of KwaZulu-Natal, the red line depicting where mostly population movement is essentially taking place. I need to share with your committee chair that we are in the process of finalizing the State of South African Cities report, and through guidance by our political principals in the Cities Network, we think that we'll be able to release that study of the State of Cities report towards the end of March, based on what the board of the Cities Network is suggesting. But what the State of Cities report also seeks to do is to try to bring to the fore some of the trends that we are talking about here. We've just finished the crime and statistics location across all of those cities, and there's a lot of interesting trends that we have picked up there. Continuing, young people are attracted to the largely urban areas. People at retirement age also seem to move into rural areas as well, and households living in poverty are also increasingly moving to large urban areas as it were. A very mobile group is the youth, and I think that's the point that I made at some point, that young people are not stagnant. They are moving as much as they can. There's big movement to urban centers, particularly metros and cities, and the big towns, from larger centers to smaller towns as well. And that's the trend that we have picked up. We haven't done a thorough analysis of that particular trend. That's why we've got notes. There's something that we're currently working with our colleagues at the CSIR. Major flows of people that were high school students between 2001 and 2011, that's indicative, and I think these are some of the factors, therefore, that make some rural municipalities lose population. Education institutions and their location are quite an important contributor to where and how municipalities move. Let me skip that other slide. Young adult seekers in Gauteng increased by about 100% in 15 years. That are people that are looking for jobs. Persons over 50 have declined significantly in the Gauteng city region. In fact, the Gauteng city region is attracting a lot of young people. You don't have to be at Tshwane to understand the magnitude with which that particular city is characterized by young people. And so Gauteng has the lowest proportion of people that are over the age of 65. And so that will then have to tell us something in relation to jobs or whatever the case might be in relation to that trend. I think this might be a repetition of what I have made mention of. Major flows of people that were economically active between 2001 and 2011, all the red dots going into orange give you a sense on the map of where those major flows of people that are economically active has been, even up to including the retirement age. There's an increase in urban poverty. There's lots of people that are unemployed or have little or limited income in the urban areas, and I think that's a point that I made earlier, Chen. And also that the Gini coefficient, that is the gap between the rich and the poor, has been one of the studies that we did. I think we shared it with the portfolio committee, was the state of finances, where we analyzed the finances, and the conclusion that we had made was that cities and towns are becoming unaffordable to the average population in terms of the cost, whether it's rates, it's electricity, water, the means of transportation between one point or the other. And that why there's an increasing amount of the Gini coefficient at city level. This map purports where poverty increase has taken place between the same period 1996 to 2011. The concentration is evident in the city regions as well as some densely populated rural areas within South Africa. The impact on Gauteng, whilst the proportion of households living in poverty is still higher in the rest of South Africa than the Gauteng city region, there is a small national increase and a significant increase of households living in poverty within the Gauteng city region, and that's what that this graph seeks to purport. Other considerations is that in addition to the issues discussed, there are other important issues that are noticeable trends that need to be considered. The first one is the fact that the size of the household continues to decrease, which means people are gaining, are getting houses, and therefore the size of the household has increased, and what the tendency is that they then tend to build out back rooms in their various yards for rental purposes, which tend into a form of income. Again, utilizing here the example of housing, that gives you a sense of the changes that have happened between comparing housing and the rest of South Africa. And you can see that housing as a province has actually been quite competitive with respect to that change of the size of the household. Other considerations, circular migration, I think I have made mention of this, the fact that populations are moving within one jurisdictional area. Fluctuating population sizes and service demands with huge impact, especially on smaller towns, because when smaller towns lose population, it also implies that they are losing the revenue, the limited revenue that they would have had those populations stayed there. Different people and households have different needs and make different choices in terms of the city area, the type of living arrangements that can best fulfill their needs. This map indicates to you, Chair, and the committee where informal housing is located in the housing city region and where the backyard housing is taking place as a result of responding to the increasing size of the population in those. Some of the assumptions, spatial proximity, we think will reduce unemployment by increasing exposure to existing jobs and opening up. Two, the household economic outcomes for in-migrant shack populations on the metro periphery are better on average than those that are at the core, which is quite a strange phenomenon. It means, by way of example, if you are poor, you are better poor in a place that has more jobs than in a place that has limited jobs. This also accounts, this account suggests that the inner district favors the well-educated, are likely to supply fewer entry-level jobs, and are closely watched by better educated, better connected, and more competitive job seekers. So the more educated the young people are, the more they are likely to find job security when they are seeking job security in these particular areas. Value chains and migrations in our cities, the South African focus. Social values have been playing a very pivotal role in shaping the rural, the urban-rural interrelationships, because the more people come to cities, the more, in fact, they tend to keep two households, one a rural household and the other one an urban household, for purposes of maintaining the social connections through the simplicity. And maintaining a link between rural and urban livelihoods, where there's a lot of remittance that takes place from urban areas into your rural areas, and the banks and the banking community have started to exploit that particular space, especially when it comes to remittance. Chair, I probably will be repetitive again in this slide. So, increasing urbanization is the result of constant population movement. And we've just concluded a study on social values in the context of migration as well, and it's highlighted to us in terms of the rural-urban interchange, at least three categories of people. There are people that are rurally, that are committed to rural areas that are not going to move. There are people that are moving between rural and urban, and there are people that just want to stay in metropolitan areas. They would have been born perhaps some in rural, and they decide that they will not go move back to their respective places of origination, that is rural areas. Urbanization in itself is not a sufficient solution to the challenges of securing reliable household income. I think that's the point that we've made earlier, and that rural migration migrants often live in very unfavorable conditions in the city center, to be closer to employment and to income opportunities. And that's because of the point that I made earlier, that urban areas are becoming more and more expensive as it went. Positive effects on migration, both at an international and the macro focus level. There's a workforce, so Gauteng, if there were jobs in Gauteng, the workforce is already existent there, but unfortunately the economy is not pumping enough to be able to create more jobs as much. So mostly the public sector is the driver of jobs, and there isn't much, comparatively speaking, that the private sector is doing in order to ensure that there are jobs, at least jobs. And obviously, I'm not necessarily saying only the private sector is to be responsible. Both the public and the private sector are responsible for public for the creation of jobs, other than the current situation where predominantly it's the public sector that is job creation. Economic growth, I think migrants boost the working age population. I think we've made the point. Migrants arrive with skills, and human capital development can actually take place. There's also a lot of technological progress that happens as a result of in-migration that we see. So migration is not something that's to be shunned upon. We think that migration, we need to find a way of working around migration to our own advantage and utilize it more as a labor rather than attempting to police the movement of people from one area to the other. But we need to create a climate that is conducive to the management of that. The other question that we were asked to address pertains to migration impact on the environment. And I think as the statistician general was saying, this issue of climate change is becoming more and more complex, to a point where we have suggested or are beginning to make suggestions in the State of Cities report that it will be futile if municipalities want to do everything and everything under the sun to try to mitigate climate change. Municipalities, we are suggesting, need to make clever choices in how they are dealing with climate change, because it's a very expensive exercise as it went. The vulnerability to climate change is also as a result of overpopulation, levels of economic wealth that link back to earlier points on the migration patterns, inequities in access to resources. I think we've spoken about about the fact that our cities, the Gini coefficient continues to be big, like that is the gap between the people that can afford and people that cannot afford. Youth unemployment remains the biggest challenge facing cities, and therefore has an impact on the general environment. And we need to start ensuring that cities grow and they play the role that they're supposed to be playing as drivers of growth. Turning the situation around, youth unemployment, we need to promote youth enterprises, respond to migration trends and population, teach or engage small business skills in school curriculum, so that when young people are leaving school, they are at least able to do something. Improve in the management of the natural resource base, and then linking the point with the earlier argument on migration exerting pressure on natural resources, suggested that we need to be much more proactive in terms of the policies that we are advocating. Encourage more interdepartmental integration in terms of how things are thought through. Negotiate that our municipalities become much more densified. At the moment, there's a lot of sprawl, which makes running the city a relatively expensive exercise, and the sustainable use of land as each way, and the visualization of livelihoods that are built on foundations of safety more than anything else. Okay. Let me stop there, sir.
Thank you very much for the presentation, ma'am. Very useful presentation for us. So. Lots of light.
Okay, colleagues, then can we entertain the discussion if you have point that you want to raise? Honorable Masson, Honorable Mitesh, Honorable Mela.
The first point is the operation of the slave attention. Communication tends to be important. You can see that in the theatre. Yet, the whole experience is mostly a very simple economic expression. So the whole theatre is very popular for Afrophobia, so I think we need to zoom in on that. It's all that knowledge that we gain from modern experience going to get lost. The second point is about the climate change. That we want to maximize the development use of that. We need to pose the question, how do we liberate the climate change from the data? Climate change is a problem. Do we see any positive things after the matter to it? Liberating the data is the point of the matter. I overlooked just very briefly at the whole unemployment. But often enough, we don't have a the capital issue, I think, in the world. So let's explore that a bit. Use the experience of that I imagine also I see there that we also talk about teaching small people skills in schools. Not a fair way. But there are many people out of school who are young, middle age and so on. And who had the loss as to how to come back to the school. There's a lot of interest, but again, very little information about this.
Hello, Ms. Hatcher.
No, Chair. I just want to ask if this migration also in your study indicates the type of race. The race issue again. Who are migrating most? I'll tell you why, Chair, because if you look at in the second slide where they were showing the most significant movement where it happened between people, you'll see Moses Botana sits mostly to Rafinha. You'll see also Ingrid sits Kedini, I understand. But there is somewhere where there's right across the red line where you see like Middenberg also goes straight to the city of Tuani. Maybe if you can explain that to us when this thing happens. And also with our brothers from Africa. It is your also your study covered where most people come from, especially from the outside the country. Which country is feeding the most, attracting most of our foreigners into this country? Where are they coming from? Because some of the states that we have seen in the statistics general year presentation, it was not telling us, because some of the world are quite different, the numbers that are there in the world that as compared with the state that we have, we find some of the words are overblown with the population, the number that we don't know that. So that we know exactly who are these people that are coming. Thanks.
Hello, Madam.
Thanks, Chair. I have two comments, and first of all, let me thank the South African Cities Network for an interesting presentation. On slide 5, the one that I asked you to go back to, the one about the net increases in population and decreases in population across the whole of South Africa, I find it quite interesting to note that in the very rural provinces, and here I'm talking the Northern Cape, the Eastern Cape, etc., that the growth is at nodal points where transport lines intersect, and that the rest of the population, or the rest of the area, is actually showing stagnation or decline. And that ties in quite well with what the Statistician General said about a nodal approach to urbanization. I just wanted to highlight that as something that maybe we need to factor in our planning, and look at, and particularly from a small town's perspective, not so much a city's perspective, but small towns and the revitalization of small towns. The second issue that I wish to raise is towards the end, and find it. It talks about spatial proximity and unemployment, and it says, first of all, it says an assumption that spatial proximity reduces unemployment by increasing exposure to existing job openings. And then it goes into a finding that the economic outcomes for in-migrant shack populations are better on average than core-zone outcomes using census-based employment, income and migration rates as indicators, and points to the risks of localized labor market saturation. The two don't quite link up. In other words, there isn't a direct link between your assumption that spatial proximity reduces unemployment and your findings. And secondly, the results appear to be based on qualitative data rather than quantitative data. I know you talk about using census-based employment, income, and migration rates, but if I read the reference at the bottom, it says it's based on qualitative interviews with each youth, etc., etc. Were there quantitative statistical measures put in place to determine these issues? If so, what was the basis for that? And can we actually say that spatial proximity reduces unemployment by increasing exposure to existing job openings? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Sean. Let me just start with the last question. So, I think the point we're making about proximity is more about suggesting that the further people live away from their places of income, the more they have to spend the little income on things such as transport. So they do not have an alternative but to use those means of transport to get to work, which is quite an expensive exercise considering the income levels of those respective households, which is why the argument we are making is almost in the same as saying that spatial proximity, which could be equal to more densification, coordinated, that's one of my colleagues that has come through, I think she'll be able to answer the question around the quality and the quantity in the statistics. But said, the point that we're making is that the more people are closer to their places of work, the better it is, because they'll be able to utilize those income for alternative growth in their households or in their own personal development. I'm going to ask Sona from the KFIR to deal with the question of how we arrived at some of the statistics, whether we're using both qualitative and quantitative data. I think, Chair, when we talk about the movement of people, there's no discrimination around whether they are black or not. This is more a geographic analysis rather than also looking at what race is moving from which area to the other. But I think we can be able to make a generic assumption here that most of them are African black that are making most of that movement. That's not to say other races within South Africa do not make, but I think we can safely say that the vast majority of them are black and African. Which countries do most people from outside South Africa come from? We don't have that information in this. We didn't look at which countries specifically, either within SADC or the continent, would those people have been coming from. Questions that have been asked by Mayor Mastonda, I think there's some of them are more comments, but let me attempt to deal with some of them. I think, Chair, the point that Mayor Mastonda is making about the need for us to leverage. Oh, sorry, I apologize. I think there are attempts to try to leverage climate change, but what we've realized is that it is an expensive exercise, because you are essentially changing the entire base of the economy away from your fossil fuel to much more cleaner technologies, and at this point in time that change is quite slow. South Africa, of course, is part and parcel of those few countries that have made the commitment already through the President that we are committing to the COP21 resolutions that are seeking to reduce carbon emissions by quite a significant percentage. So I think from that point of view, hopefully, we should be able to mobilize as many stakeholders as possible, including business in particular, to respond to the issue of climate change. The issues with climate change has always been about the resources. Who's going to plant the financial resources in a way to also try to respond to the issue of climate change? How do we deal with unemployed, out-of-school youth as well? I think that's a point to be taken that we will need to consider as we make the suggestions on how it is that we should be dealing with youth and youth unemployment. Chair, the point that was raised as well around the strain that exists, which then plays itself out there through phenomena such as xenophobia, I think that's the point that has been taken. We haven't shied away from this point. In the State of Cities report that I'm suggesting will be produced next year, there's a chapter that's dealing with good governance there, and in there we're also dealing with the issue of the social, economically driven social tensions, and then at the right time we will be making the correct recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, colleagues, any other comments? Do you want to make a comment? I know that we're not running with them to the day, but you're always informed about this. Okay, colleagues, thank you very much.
So, Chief, can I just get an ask my question on the late? Can I put it again?
Yeah.
My question related to the there's a slide that talks about spatial proximity reducing unemployment by increasing exposure to jobs. And my question related to the statistical basis on which that finding that is reached is made. Because primarily at the bottom it talks about qualitative interviews and youth interviews, etc. It doesn't seem to be based on statistical data, rather anecdotal.
I'm not sure exactly
about probably about 8% base from the end.
The map that shows backyard check, the slide following that one.
Make a presentation is almost correlating what the statistician general say, and I think it's very informative information for us, and it assists us who are dealing with these issues. Matter when mayor of Umtata, Papalo City is far away for you. Touch of me, want one king there to give you something. Okay. No, that's fine. And I think it's a good presentation for us, this information informing us. We can move to the next presentation by the department. The department, of course, they got some issues to raise, and the deputy minister is here. And we know that Stark, of course, didn't come because they got their enemies. Honorable Deputy Minister, any point that you want to take us through?
Yeah, I think thank you very much for putting this issue on the agenda of the Portfolio Committee. I think it's one of the big issues confronting our country. I was listening to a presentation the other day by an academic based in India, and he referred to urbanization not as a meta trend, as a giga trend. It's one of those things that, you know, in the history of civilization really stands out as a major milestone. I mean, the transition from hunter-gatherer existence to agriculture, and so on. So I think it's really epoch-making stuff. I think yesterday we celebrated Africa Day. I think it deserves mention that over a third of Africa's 1 billion inhabitants currently live in urban areas. By 2030, that proportion would have risen to half. According to the UN, the population of some cities on our continent is set to swell to 85% over the next 15 years. The most populous city on the continent now is Cairo. It will grow by 23% to 13.5 million people. By 2025, however, Cairo would have been overtaken by both Lagos with 15.8 million and Kinshasa with 15 million people. So Africa is a continent along with Asia and other parts of the developing world that is urbanizing extremely rapidly. I think we can also recall that Africa has a very rich history of great cities such as Timbuktu, Great Zimbabwe, and closer to home also Maputo. So South African cities are shaped by the legacy of apartheid, of racial segregation, poverty, exclusion from social and economic opportunities. Despite the very phenomenal service delivery gains since 1994, spatial patterns in South Africa have stubbornly resisted transformation. South Africa is also urbanizing rapidly. The UN estimates, well, I think it's two-thirds of South Africa's population at the moment live in urban areas. UN estimates that 71% of South Africa's population will live in urban areas by 2030, nearly 80% by 2050. So therefore South Africa's urban population is also growing larger and younger. It's a point made by the previous presentation. So two-thirds of South African youth live in urban areas. I think very significantly, cities and large towns produce over 80% of the national gross value added. Metros are growing twice as fast as other cities. Towns have much higher, by about 40% average incomes compared to the country as a whole. Employment grew twice as fast in metros. Between 1996 and 2012, metros accounted for 75% of all net jobs created in South Africa. However, despite this, we also see what cities network refers to as the urbanization of poverty, especially in townships, informal settlements, and in inner cities. So urban areas are dynamically linked to rural areas, the flow of people, natural and economic resources. Urban and rural areas are becoming increasingly integrated as a result of better transport, communications, and migration. The interdependence of rural and urban spaces needs a comprehensive and integrated approach to urban development. Really what we're saying is that urban development and rural development should never be seen as opposite sides or seen in contrast, in opposition to each other. So the high concentrations of people, buildings and infrastructure increases risk to natural disasters and climate change and variability. Reducing urban risk is critical to achieving sustainable urban growth. Safety, particularly in public spaces, is an essential ingredient for the creation of livable and prosperous cities. I think Mr. Terry is going to present a little bit more on, from a disaster management angle, on the shape and functioning of our cities. We were saying that urban spaces need to be designed and managed in a way that makes cities feel safe from violence and crime. The point behind the integrated urban development framework is that we need to reap the so-called urban dividend. There's a lot to be gained out of urbanization and cities. There's also a lot of downward trends. But if we believe that if we do urbanization, if we manage urbanization correctly, we get people, jobs, livelihood, opportunities, and services aligned, we can unlock those synergies that come from coordinated investments in people and places. We want cities to be inclusive, resilient, and livable. We believe that this integrated urban development framework marks a new deal for South Africa's cities and towns. The IUDF builds on the National Development Plan vision for urban South Africa. The NDP puts the transformation of human settlements and the national space economy at its very center. Chapter 8, a very important chapter for this committee. So we believe that by 2030, we do things right. We should be seeing the revival of rural areas, but also creating more integrated, balanced, and vibrant urban settlements. But in order to achieve that, we are going to need to pursue very relentlessly a vision for spatial development. And that we must also sharpen the instrument to achieve that vision and to build the required capabilities in the state and amongst citizens. So the vision of the IUDF is livable, safe, efficient cities that are socially integrated, economically inclusive, and where residents participate actively in urban life. I think that vision recognizes that South Africa has different types of cities and towns, which have different roles and requirements. The IUDF vision must be interpreted and pursued in differentiated and locally relevant ways. IUDF has four strategic goals: access, growth, growth, governance, and social transformation. And we believe that those core goals could be achieved by 8 policy levers, really premised on an understanding that firstly, spatial planning would form the basis of achieving integrated urban development. Secondly, that integrated transport informs targeted investments into integrated human settlements, which in turn are underpinned by integrated infrastructure systems and efficient land governance. Those things jointly can trigger economic diversification and inclusion and empowered communities, which will demand the deep governance reform to enable and sustain all of the above things. In the presentation that will be done by Ms. Andesa Kabeni, she'll expand in greater detail on those policy levers and how they fit into each other. She'll also speak about the consultation process that is happening at the moment. The document has been very, very widely consulted. And we would urge that the portfolio committee may be working together with other committees in the NA and the NCOP, maybe workshop this issue, exactly because of its cross-sectoral nature. We are working, I'm working very, very closely with the Deputy Ministers of Finance, of Human Settlements, Water Sanitation, Rural Development and Land Reform, Transport, Environmental Affairs and Economic Development on this document. We constitute a political steering committee. But I think I'd just like to conclude by making the point that these things are happening now as we speak. In the budget debate, I quoted Gil Scott-Heron, that the revolution will be live, it will not be televised. So urbanization is also live, not going to be televised. It's happening as we speak. So it's not something that can wait for the finalization of the IEDs. And I think what's good is that already cities, provinces, and national departments have initiated action. In the present budget already, Treasury is starting to align public spending to support spatial restructuring of urban areas by modifying the infrastructure grant to support mixed-use, mixed-income precincts, to have performance-based allocations to reward cities that demonstrate progressive changes in their urban form and improve access to basic services. Also refocusing the neighborhood development program to support the development of economic hubs in large urban areas. And also Treasury is working with a range of municipalities, such as Joburg on the Corridors of Freedom, Cape Town on the Metro Southeast Corridor, and the Cornubia development in eThekwini. Also, I mean, many of the elements of the Back to Basics approach are exactly designed to improve the capacity of our cities to manage urbanization. I think, Chair, at the end of the day, this is an issue that has huge ramifications both economically but also socially for the country. Because whether we get the issue of urban development and spatial transformation right is going to determine whether we realize the vision of the Constitution of becoming a nation united in our diversity, or just a group of people living together separately. I know that when we raised some of these issues during the budget debate, it also provoked a little bit of excitement from some. But I think these are issues that shouldn't divide us. They should actually unite us into a common national purpose. So I thank you very much, and I'll then hand to Ms. Kabeni to just take us through in some great detail on some of the policy levers and the consultation process, and Mr. Terry will speak a bit about
much, Mr. Minister. Let us allow you to make a presentation.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Tammy Bakarini, and I'm part of the team that is driving the consultation the process of the IUDF. So I'll quickly take you through some of the processes and consultations we've done so far, but I want to pay more attention to some of the key issues that are coming out of those consultations, some of the image and content issues as well that we've been receiving. And then I'll just also, in my concluding statement, take you through the current IUDF priorities, like what we're currently working on and what we're working towards, and sort of like outline some of the time frames that you're working towards. So as you might all know, that the IUDF process started back in 2012, where discussion document was released for consultation. And then we had the paper document that was taken to the cabinet, and in 2014 we were allowed to go out with the consultation process. So we started with consultation on the IUDF in November last year, and we're currently doing consultation. And there's been so much demand for us to engage with other sectors that we're supposed to finish the consultation period in March, but because of the demand that we've been getting, we've extended the period now to June for consultation. Deputy Minister spoke about the IUDF goals. I will not try to repeat those, but what I will start to talk about is the content issues behind those IUDF goals. So some of the issues that we're responding to in the IUDF are based on the current South African realities that we're facing, as what's presented here today, the whole issue around urbanization. So the trend is that our population growth is obviously increasing in our urban areas. That's a phenomenon that the IUDF is mostly responding to, the whole issue around urbanization. South African population is increasingly young, often with very low education levels and predominantly poor. So that's another challenge that we're facing with. And it was the whole issue of urbanization of poverty was mentioned, and in the IUDF we make the reference to the fact that 64% of our youth are currently living in urban areas, and that's a key challenge that we have to address. I mean, it speaks directly to what we do spatially in order for us to address some of the youth challenges that we're facing. We also acknowledge that our urban areas are very much, they still remain largely segregated, and that our municipalities are facing enormous challenges with regards to service delivery and keeping up with the pace of increasing demand on the urban resources. So as the future minister stated, it is therefore very important that we came up with this policy that will start to speak to how we manage our urban areas going into the future. Taking into consideration that by 2050 we'll have about 80% of our population living in urban areas. So just to say that then these IUDF goals, they try to respond to some of these key issues that I've spoken about, and these include the spatial transformation as an IUDF goal. Now in the consultations that we've had, it's been very interesting how people define spatial transformation, and one of the issues that we've been tasked going ahead with the IUDF is that we need to define what exactly we mean by spatial transformation. And we've been receiving various responses to how people see spatial transformation. And currently in the IUDF it's not really fully defined, but it's one of the key critical issues going forward that we'll need to address. It's also not clear how one would measure spatial transformation, whether you put targets in place, whether you do that by time frames or monitoring systems. And the key question that you ask when you go to the consultation session is, what is a transformed city? And the kind of responses that you get from different people, it's been very widely accepted, but with a very common feature that's coming to play. The fact that, you know, most people always make reference to the spatial organization of our cities is one of the key priorities for spatial transformation. So the other IUDF goals talk to inclusion imperative and economic imperative. So the what you're currently trying to do with the IUDF as well is to, as the future minister pointed out, to reap the rewards of urbanization, because currently in South Africa we are not reaping the rewards of urbanization. When one speaks of urbanization, it's a phenomenon that everybody sees a negative aspect out of it, and that's because it comes with, currently the way that it's happening, it's very much negatively perceived to be a bad issue. So within the IUDF, we believe that bringing the people, the economy, and places and planning for those, we can then start reaping the urban dividends. So the whole issue is that you need to maximize the potential of urban areas by aligning investment in people, in the place, and in the economy as well, where we believe that investment in the economy will complement the investment in people to better have to enhance their capabilities. And we believe that if we do special targeting and planning, we can then start seeing fruitful you know, projects happening on the ground that will then benefit the communities as a whole. So the policy is it's got a vision to it, as was stated earlier, and there's strategic goals which are just spoken to. And then we have 8 policy levers within the IUDF. The first lever being that of integrated spatial planning. The second one is around integrated transport planning, around human settlements. And then the fourth one is around integrated infrastructure network systems. The fifth lever talks to efficient land governance, and the sixth one is around economic diversification and inclusion. And then we also recognize the including communities in policy making. So the seventh one is around empowering communities. And then the last one is around governance reform. I can go through the content of these levers after the presentation, because what I want to focus more on is the content issues that are coming out, because that content issues that's coming out of the consultation is starting to shape the way that we're thinking about the process of the IUDF going forward. But if there's a request that I go through the policy levers after the presentation, I'll get into that as well. So within the 8 policy levers, there are cross-cutting issues which we have identified. And these issues, it means that with each and every lever, one needs to take into account these 3 cutting issues. The first one is the rural-urban linkages. Just because this is more of an urban policy, we're also paying attention to the rural areas, because there is a need, and it's very crucial that when we speak about the urban areas, we also address the rural areas and try to understand why people are moving into urban areas. And it's through the engagements that we've had, we've heard people saying, you know, they would rather live in rural areas, but because of the economic factors and poverty in rural areas, they tend to migrate to urban areas. And we had very interesting engagements with institutions like at the University of Johannesburg and West University, for example, where we were speaking to the youth as well, and they were talking about these issues, why they prefer being in urban areas rather than rural areas. So those linkages is very important for us to address. And it was quite interesting, because when we talked to the elder people of the when we're doing the consultation, the perceptions are a bit different, because the older generation, they prefer going back to their rural homestead instead of being in the city. And therefore it became very clear for us that, you know, there's also a need, you know, to plan as much as we're planning for the rural areas, to plan for those areas as well, as much as we're planning for the urban areas. The issues around urban safety is also a cutting issue, and it's something that we're saying within municipalities, their plans and policies, right from the planning to implementation, they need to have urban safety features. And this also talks to the whole principle of back to basics, going back to basics, and, you know, the whole idea of making sure that, you know, the street lights are working and so forth. Those add to the overall safety of an area, and it's something that we really emphasize in that in the plans. another cross-cutting issue is around disaster risk and reduction in climate change, and that's the broad umbrella of the environmental factors. But what we've been criticized on is that we're rather looking at environmental issues not in a proactive way, but in the IUDF, so there was a proposal that the environmental issue needs to be a policy lever on its own, and and that's something that we need to be discussing further. So, like I mentioned before, we started a consultation in October, November last year, and as part of the continued consultation process, we've launched a website. It's www.iudf.net. It's currently in operational. So what we do in the website, we obviously update people around the process of the IUDF. One can also download the IUDF from there, but there's also a column as well where people could register and where people could also put in their comments and around the content issues of the IUDF. We're also very much active on social media as well, such as Twitter and so the consultation processes that we have done so far, they include provincial consultations. So we've consulted with all the provinces, and the one province that is currently outstanding for us to go to is the Limpopo province, but all the other provinces we've gone through. And then we've also had sector-based consultations where we were hosted by some of our partners, including CSIR, Isandla Institute, SAUGA, Human Source Research Council, and other institutions such as VET as well. So the nature of the sector-based consultation is that we would look at one policy lever, and then various people were invited to those. And with each session, we had a number of approximately 30 to 35 people in the room, and then we would discuss some of those levers in detail. And then we've also had other consultations with CLASA, for example, when we talk about the integrated transport and mobility. We're going to have one with the National Business Initiative in the next coming week, and that will deal around economic growth. And then with the University of Pretoria, they've been keen to discuss the rural urban linkages, and we'll be having those in the next coming week. So we've also presented the IUDF document to a number of IGR structures as listed in the slide. So the whole idea is that after we've done all these consultations, we've got a team of consultants that were appointed to take minutes and discussions at the meeting venues. So we'll have, at the end of the day, a booklet containing all the information that we have received from the consultation, which we will then use to use as information background for the redrafting of the IUDF. And those the input that is received as well will also be made available to some of the people who are willing to engage with the content of what's coming out of the consultation session. So some of the emerging issues that have come out of the consultation issues, which I just want to bring your attention to. The first one is that the IUDF policy is widely accepted by most people that we've consulted. There is a bias to that. We noticed in the consultation sessions that there is a bit of fatigue when one speaks of new policies that are coming out. So at first, people will be very much reluctant, like, why do we need another policy? Don't we have enough policies and so forth? But once you explain what the IUDF aims to achieve, then we find out that people started to buy into the process. And I can say 80%, 90% of the time, it was very much well received. There's also a very lot of expectations that's coming out of the people that we've consulted around what the IUDF can achieve. So I mean, we've come to a point now where, you know, we've been told even in the consultation sessions that, you know, this, if we can't deliver with this policy, then people don't know when we will start delivering. So there's lots of excitement and there's lots of expectations of what the IGF can actually do. There were also queries about the National Special Development Framework and how the IUDF fits within the ambit of government policies and plans. And there was a bit of confusion of where the policy fits in and how it's going to align some of the policies that are currently, some other sector policies that you currently have. Because one of the key roles of the IUDF as well is that it aims to align different sector departments plans and policies, and that's one of the key reasons that we actually having it, the fact that we haven't really reached implementation as different departments. Well, some argue that implementation has been there, but because it's uncoordinated implementation, one is failing to see what it's achieving or how if it's making improvements in the lives of people. So one of the key issues is that the HKS aims to form that institutional base where all the policies from different sectors could be aligned. The whole issue around spatial transformation, as I noted earlier, has been a very key issue and level of debate within the consultation period. And we were asked a very interesting question on how we're going to make sure that the IUDF plans or the plans that come out of the IUDF will be implementable or enforceable. And I think what people were alluding to was the fact that how are we going to implement a policy at a national level, knowing very well that, you know, plans are implemented at a local level. So how at national level are we going to do a policy and then come up with the implementation framework of the policy, and how are we going to see that? And I forgot to mention at the beginning that the IUDF will actually have an implementation framework to it, and we've been questioned a lot around that, what form will this implementation framework be, how are we going to make sure that it's implemented, and then it was interesting when we spoke with municipalities because they felt very threatened now to be given another policy or tool that they need to be implementing, whereas they've got their own implementation or sector plans and so forth. And what we try to stress as well is that the IUDF is not there to dictate what municipalities need to be doing, but it's there to give guidance to their plans as well. And that, you know, it doesn't give solutions for each and every province. Municipalities will need to sit down and see how the IUDF fits within their context. And when we talk about projects that could be implemented as a form of spatial transformation in the IUDF, we're not going to come as national government and tell them what to do, but the plan is that we need to work with them with the existing projects that they currently have and give support to those and make sure that through those projects we can achieve this whole concept of spatial transformation. So that gave them a bit of a relief, and I must say that there is really a nervousness at a local level on us giving them another tool that they have to administer through. So it was also interesting that the role of the private sector and civil society, it was one of those key issues that were coming out a lot, and we feel that it was such a good input as well, what role the private sector plays in spatial transformation and what role in the IUDF are we placing the private sector. I do not really have an answer for that, but it was just a question that came out. And then there was also a highlight that, you know, we need to be working very closely with our fiscal, because without a sound financial management plan, the whole idea of a spatial transformation will remain a past dream. And I think that's why even Minister now indicated that we're working very closely with other national departments such as Treasury as well, and moving towards a space now where planning needs to inform budgeting and so forth. So I think I'll just leave the key issues there. And then just going forward is that we're still currently doing the consultation. And then after the consultations, we will then regroup and go through the rewriting process. That will be around October sometime. And then we're also working at the same time on the implementation framework while we're doing consultation processes. We've started, you know, debating on the implementation framework, how it would look like, and we did the consulting with other experts in the field on how we go about the implementation framework. And then I think that I will end the presentation there. And just a last note to say that we need as much people to be exposed to this document and people to engage with this document. And through forums such as these, we also rely on you as well to take the documents and the contents thereof to your respective, what's the word? Yes, so that we can get as much buy-in to the process and as much feedback as we can possibly get. And I think with those words, I will lead you to that. Please do visit our website, www.idf.net. You can register as an interested party and you will get updated responses of where we are in the IUTF as well. And for those who tweet as well, we're very much active on Twitter. You can follow us at IUTF_Copter. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. The chapter's an adjustment of out. I think from the I think if there are no comments, the that's a presentation to the department.
Thank you, Chairperson. The effects of climate change and the migration on municipalities, and it's from a disaster management perspective that I'm going to be speaking to you. The second part of this presentation I'm not going to deal with because I think we've had some extensive discussions on the integrated urban development framework and how things have been going forward. Climate-related disasters are by far the most frequent natural disasters. Annually, they cause loss of life, the impact on livelihoods, and cause harm to our infrastructure, our societies, and economies. And this is not only limited to South Africa, but it's all over the world. The latest scientific analysis accentuates exposure and vulnerability as the largest contributors of overall risk, thereby highlighting the need for comprehensive risk management measures to ensure a way to cope with increasing climate risk. There's a whole lot of documentation and legislation that deals with climate change. There is a National Climate Change Response Policy that was published as a white paper and the Government Gazette on 19 October 2011. There's the National Development Plan, Chapter 5, which speaks to the environmental sustainability and resilience, the social protection in Chapter 11, and also the work of the NDMC that supports climate change adaptation approach of the government's National Climate Change Response Policy. We in the disaster environment deal with the adaptation to what the scientists are saying is going to happen and how we make sure that we can put measures and systems in place to prevent any risks from or disasters from happening. The Department of Environmental Affairs is a member of the Disaster Management Advisory Forum, and one of the standing agenda items is about issuing climate change adaptation and how this relates to the disaster management environment. We participate as the Disaster Management Center in various forums of the Department of Environmental Affairs to ensure that there's integration of disaster risk reduction and climate change adaptation matters. One of the actions in the Outcome 10 Delivery Agreement includes climate change risks in the disaster management plans. One of the working groups of the integrated climate change also deals with long-term adaptation scenarios and the disaster risk reduction with specific areas of focus there. The trends and projections, there are some evidence that rainfall since 1950 has included both drying trends in parts of the summer rainfall region and wetting trends in part of the winter rainfall season regions. Honourable members, the one thing that we have as a biggest risk in terms of urbanization from a disaster management perspective is water shortage in the country. The majority of your urban areas are built around in areas where the water shortage is quite high, and we're of the view that in the future, if this is not addressed quite adequately, the more the huger the influx and the less water there is. And this is a sustainability issue. Water is part of staying alive. This is not just making sure that your garden's flowers grow. It's a huge risk for us, and this is one of the primary risks that we are dealing with in terms of environmental affairs at the moment. The sea level is rising around South African coast, but also there are differences in the different regions, and future warming due to increased international emissions, the carbon emissions, the projections to be the greatest in the interior of South Africa and lost long, you know, in the coastal area and the least along the coastal areas. So these are also issues that we had also heard about how we're going to be dealing with the carbon emissions in the future, which has a huge impact because we primarily still use coal for power generation. Just a slide that speaks of climate change and the frequency and the severity of how we've been seeing the disasters over the past few years, it's quite the frequency and the severity has risen quite substantially. The impact of climate change, it's impacting on hydrometeorological or weather-related hazards by alternating their frequency and intensity, and is expected to become more extreme in the future. Climate change will also have long-term impacts such as gradually increasing temperatures, changing seasons, unpredictable rain, and the rising of sea levels. Climate change poses a threat to sustainable development. If not mitigated, it has the potential to undermine the achievement of our development goals. Risk reduction, climate or disaster risk, is the probability or likelihood that a hazard or long-term change will cause injury, damage or loss. It is related to the magnitude of the hazard and to capacity and vulnerability of the community. If the capacity in the community is high, risk is low, but if the vulnerability is high, the risk will also be high. Therefore, risk reduction involves both increasing capacity and the reducing of vulnerability. The characteristics of hazards have changed, and the level of exposure to risk for some regions is high. Rising of the sea level, abnormal rainfall and extreme weather conditions. The increase in extreme events will strain public resources due to the need to declare and support disaster areas in an immediate crisis, as well as in terms of the long-term recovery. The sectorial climate change impacts, and that's why the disaster management forums are it's so important that we have all our sector departments on board and play a critical role in the adaptations, is the water sector. The economic analysis on water sector highlights that the biggest projected cost impact will be damage to infrastructure resulting from more frequent and intense flood events. Increased water scarcity in many parts of the country will result in increased prices for water. In smaller towns and municipalities, it is likely that the cost burden will fall mainly on the middle and low-end users, and the delivery of free basic services in terms of water to households will potentially be compromised. In the agricultural sector, analysis on the impact of climate change on profits of the commercial agricultural sector estimates significant negative impact on the national economy, with field crops facing the greatest losses, and they are generally not irrigated. And this has a big impact on food security in the country. Forestry, there is a projected likely loss of productivity in the current areas of plantation forestry, particularly in the Western Cape, due to decreases in rainfall. The impact of climate change in related to disaster risks. Climate change calls for increased investment in resources in local action and better adaptation, more effective early warning systems, need to give priority to disaster management structures. The SADC, the SADC region, is vulnerable to a range of natural disasters, and since many events affect several countries simultaneously, a regional approach to managing the risks is appropriate and necessary. Participation in regional structures must be strengthened. Importance of disaster risk reduction in an integrated development planning process is also critical. The strategies that we have in place, and this is the adaptation to climate change, strengthening institutional arrangements and working relationships, various structures, the national climate change, the process is initiated to establish government component, amending the Disaster Management Act, as we have been speaking about in recent weeks, the review of our fire services legislation, the signing of MOUs with organs of state and key institutions such as the Weather Service, the Defence Force, etc. Cross-border assistance with neighbouring countries, exploring MOUs and protocols so that we can our adaptation processes are aligned, and then supporting the functioning of disaster management centres across the spheres of all the spheres of government. The municipal support initiatives is the developing and improving of multi-hazard early warning systems with the SA Weather Service and other stakeholders, and making sure this is disseminated in an appropriate way. Establishing indicative national risk profiles, and these are done over a number of years to see what the profiles are and what the infrastructure and areas that are at risk are. The monitoring and coordination of the development of disaster management plans across the spheres of government, and various research capabilities and capacity building and awareness initiatives that are taking place. Other municipal support initiatives is the climate change response toolkit for municipalities. This is to guide and assist municipalities to identify sectors that are most at risk. The Clean Communities Program, this has to do with waste management, cleanup campaigns, and recycling. The massive greening campaign, where open spaces are green, trees are planted, and in terms of climate change, the project has positive effect on the mitigation of impact of the climate change as well. There are a number of advocacy programs that also take place from the disaster management environment. As an organization advocating the principles of disaster risk reduction and also dealing with the impacts of disasters, the key messages on climate change adaptation, these include climate change as consequences that affect all our communities. Communities can build resilience through climate change, and climate change adaptation needs investment and in disaster management as well at the local level. The other advocacy measure is that for the NDMC to define its advocacy role on climate-related disasters, close alignment between the related processes of disaster risk reduction, resilience, climate change, adaptation is needed in the upcoming years. And this is not only done through the NDMC, all our sector and sister departments have to play a critical role as far as that is concerned. We cannot afford to perpetuate the disconnect between disaster risk reduction, sustainable development, and climate change. Knowledge and information generated through risk management approaches and disaster risk reduction activities contribute to climate risk management and to understanding the managing of losses and the damages linked to climate change impacts. Managing disaster risk enables countries and communities to sustain their social economic development, it saves lives, and potentially reduces economic losses and improves the effectiveness of disaster preparedness, response, and recovery. Some of the institutional mechanisms is through the UN, United Nations, and the global facilities for disaster reduction. With the minister, we were in Japan, where the Sendai Framework for Disaster Risk Reduction acknowledges that disasters, many of which are exacerbated, aggravated by climate change, and increasing in frequency and intensity was discussed at length. It recognizes that intergovernmental negotiations on the post-2015 development agenda, financing for development, climate change and disaster risk reduction provide the international community with a unique opportunity to enhance coherence in the implementation of policies and all sorts of other issues as listed over there. And this is, from an international perspective, there's a huge willingness by all countries all over the world to ensure that the issue of disaster risk reduction is put on the agenda of all, globally and of all countries, to make sure that that the climate change effects are taken into consideration. And then addressing climate change as one of the drivers of disaster risk while respecting the mandate of the United Nations framework on climate change represents an opportunity to reduce disaster risk in a meaningful and coherent manner throughout the interrelated intergovernmental processes. I think the one issue that I just want to raise, it was not part of the presentation, but in Sendai when we were there with the minister, one of the discussions that there was around urbanization was the concept of old and new urbanization, the old and new infrastructure. Where urbanization is taking place in an area that has traditionally been an urban area and was built to accommodate, just by way of an example, 1 million people. We saw statistics this morning where urbanization has grown substantially, where you've got 5,000 or 5 million people now in the same urban area where the infrastructure was created for a smaller group, and how do we get that infrastructure up to standard to accommodate all those people? It's easy to speak of service delivery, but the impacts of the urbanization is not always taken into consideration. And then you find that in a lot of these urban areas where the new infrastructure does have to take place, that the space is a problem in terms of spatial planning and how that is managed. And that versus relatively new urban areas that have been developed where the spatial planning can be done in such a way that one can accommodate that. Chairperson, I think that is, in essence, where the NDMC is coming from. We would have heard from one of the professors that did a presentation on our amendment bill that puts forward a notion that there is no such thing as a natural disaster, that the earth has got its own way of dealing with issues and that people get in its way, and that's where disasters come from. But the reality is that we deal with disasters on a daily basis. So, Chairperson, thank you very much. I think that concludes the presentation.
I'd like to make a request to honorable members to allow the input from CSIR to be made, because all of these things are related. And then a discussion only after that. If members are free.
Thank you. it doesn't have the economy of the big cities. And then you talk about 20% of the country's people actually staying in that place. And that's quite significant. And it's quite significant in terms of the service of living crisis. And I think then, if we start then to talk about what have we seen over recent years in terms of growth, then the big impact is obviously being in terms of numbers in our city regions, in our cities. But also, I think we all know the stories about Leparole, the stories about Dusseldorf, the sort of secondary cities, but then the story about smaller places. Some of the work that we've done in the Northern Cape, if you start looking at simulating future growth scenarios, where mining areas might start closing down, what would be typically the implication when would people move to? Then it raises some serious questions about places like Kimberley, some of our secondary cities, and I think we're seeing that already. The results of people moving towards places where there's a perception no longer just about jobs and employment, but about services and about the diversity of opportunity. And in many ways, cities provide that, and our big towns as well. So I think one of the things that maybe that's sort of part of looking at the climate change issues is the challenge, and in the cities we often agree, is that these things are beyond the scope of the city. It's beyond the scope of urban governance. And I think one of the questions probably is that a lot of what is in the IUDF is about urban governance. But I think we definitely, I think we definitely need more strategies from national governments. We need national governments to not just do projects, to not just do catalytic projects, to not just do infrastructure investments, but to have a concerted strategy about urban development throughout the range of places in South Africa. And I think that's one of the things that sort of almost without just, that's got a fantastic in terms of the IUDF looking in at urban governance. But I think the issues around climate change, I mean, we heard this just today, and issues around migration, development across the board, those are issues that really need some serious, almost non-urban governance in order to make sure that urban governance can work, and really to support the city in that course. I think one of the slides that I would maybe like to sort of just spend some time on is I think what we see throughout the country is a highly mobile population. People are moving, money is moving. We see people migrating in and out. I think we all have experience of that. We see almost like hollow towns in some parts of our country where the rich migrate in on a daily basis or weekly basis to work. Where there's a lot of people that actually move and stay in that area but don't have necessarily families with them. But it's very little actually sort of what you would think about in a normal way, a town kind of activity. So there are places, I think, in our country where vulnerability is serious. And if we start looking at that, I think it's also been mentioned by Mr. Bongo, it's been mentioned by the department as well, that people make choices to actually, I think, contrary to what we would like to see, I think people are forced to make choices, obviously, but that there is a complete different spatial pattern unfolding in terms of what kind of spaces give opportunities to what kind of activities, to what kind of livelihoods. And more, I think we see in our cities that there's a need for different solutions. There are needs that really cater for young people that's not family affiliated. And we'll see in some of our slides, this work that we're doing, working with this network, we're really starting to look at the sub-city level. Let's track those changes. Let's look at what happened in terms of spatial transformation. The technology is now there that one can actually start doing. What has changed? Where did poverty increase? Where did change take place? And you know. And if one starts looking at those in-city figures, we want to actually see where poverty has been increased. But I think one of the big things that we also see is that those, if we talk about Gini coefficients and places that we measure in terms of equity, then our places that are growing economies are the ones that's doing the work. And I think one of the key things is probably how do we make those calls? How do we measure? How do we make sure that we've got spaces that actually can cater for diverse needs? to not going to go to the site, but you'll see also in some of the presentation there's a bit of an analysis on the smaller towns as well. And I think from the department side as well, I mean, the issue around financial viability. If your town has doubled in size in the last 5 years, there's no way that the municipality can be financially viable in terms of service delivery. And I think those are the kind of challenge, even if it might be in lower growth, the double of size of population, that type of impact on the municipality is huge. And often when we deal with the municipalities, we think about them as municipal heads. But in essence, 80-90% of people are living in settlements in towns, big towns in those settlements. So maybe once again, the and then maybe just to add on to the last presentation, just something around the climate change. What is quite useful, and I'm sure it's been part of what you said into the department's process already, is the climate change projections that's been done for static. So there has been a range of sort of global change models and that we managed to do downscales and there's now no promotion for the CSIR, that's not my unit, but there's a lot of work that's been done by the CSIR around climate change modeling. But I think some of the key things that come out of temperature, definitely temperature rises, the three big models in the country sort of are in agreement around that. 2-3% extreme weather events have been mentioned, and decrease in rainfall. So I think in terms of climate change implications, we've sort of highlighted 5 things. And I think we want to start with the energy crunch. We're all aware of the energy issue. Energy as part of climate change is a major thing, not just in terms of vulnerability, in terms of the economy. So the energy crunch, the water crunch, and then the big thing is the urban and land use transformation crunch. Contentious land use, especially in our urban areas, in our big metros, in the peripheral areas. Service delivery and spatial differentiation. A major impact in terms of how are we going to provide services in resource-scarce environments. How are we going to provide services if we do not look at these issues of urban South Africa in context of the country. The water, in terms of water quality, water availability, all of those kind of things. And then I think one of the big things that Susie also mentioned was that even water issues, service issues, would then be a complex issue around diseases, around health, public health. So I think in essence, maybe in exposure, to just make the case that the issue we see around climate change will also once again impact firstly in our agriculture areas, forestry, food production, which will once again have an impact in terms of concentration, movement of people, migration. So these things I think are all related, and the reason why we need really a concerted effort by our government to support cities and big towns and surviving and providing for the people of this country.
Thank you very much. There we are, the colleagues and honorable members. As we can see, I mean, the issues are really related. And it may be very useful to discuss them at the same time. Even if we can't exhaustively discuss and conclude them today, just to have a sense that these matters must be pursued in a particular manner going forward. So issues that have been raised to climate change, impact of climate change, the issues of migration, and the impact of migration, and obviously the question of scope of intergovernmental development framework. And then we've gone to discuss the input, so we've gone to look at the input by CSIR, and that input, amongst other things, refers to issues of climate change, the modeling, issues of rainfall, and energy crunch, what's it called, energy crunch, water crunch, service delivery, special differentiation on water. See, zero in on the question of quality of water, availability, health and related matters. So these issues are related. They are related. Me, what you should do is to pose a question. Are there any comments that members want to make so that when we do revisit the issues again, there's a bit of a sense about whatever guidance members are able to provide in this meeting. Yes, Dylan.
Chair, thank you. We've had some really insightful presentations this morning, but most of them have been focused on migration patterns and urban growth. And I was certainly expecting a lot more from the NDMC and the department with regard to climate change. What I'm worried about here is that we haven't seen anything about the scope of the risk to municipalities. We don't know which municipalities are most at risk. We don't know what they are at risk to, because not every municipality is affected by sea level increases. We don't know what the knock-on effects are. If there is a sea level increase in Cape Town, does it mean that there's going to be migration inland or so on? You know, we haven't seen any kind of analysis of that. We haven't seen what the implications are for municipalities in terms of climate change to their ability to provide basic services. What is it going to do to their water reticulation? What is it going to do to their transport reticulation? What is it going to do to their electricity reticulation? We haven't spoken about the economic impact of climate change. It's been touched on very briefly about agriculture and forestry in both the departmental and the CFIR presentation. But really, it's a much bigger issue than just the sector itself. It's about all the associated sectors that support those sectors. You know, transportation. What's the impact, for example, if climate change impacts on forestry, it's going to reduce or change the type of forestry that gets done. They're not going to be able to do it in Limpopo anymore, but they might do it now in the Eastern Cape. And we need to then put in place economic support measures to address that. There are people that are going to be out of jobs, there are new people that are going to get jobs. We haven't discussed any of those implications at all. So what I'm really concerned about is that this presentation is very superficial. It's very broad brushstrokes. Climate change is coming, sea levels rising, the temperature's going up, but where? Who's affected? What are the impacts, and what are we going to do about it? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm so glad you know that these discussions are big discussions by themselves. The principles of migration and climate change, the matters is getting discussed in a whole range of UN agencies, UN itself, EU, in the AU, in various non-governmental organizations and civil society organizations. So the debate is ongoing. And there have been numerous meetings that have been held, summits of heads of state preceded by departments engaging the issues and so on. So clearly, we started the process here that may require us to engage on matters much, much more in depth as suggested by Member Milan. So we know the point. But,
sorry.
Thank you. And maybe one must thank all the presenters for the insightful information that they've given us. From the Statistician General to the last presentation. I think what all these presentations are pointing up to is that humanity currently is facing a huge phenomenon of movement of people from one area to another. And therefore the challenge for the authorities to plan accordingly for that big movement. And I think what is also clear is that this is not only a South African phenomenon. This is an international phenomenon. It is happening almost throughout the world. Cities, governments are contending with this phenomenon on a daily basis. Not only migration within countries, but also immigration and emigration. So this is something that we are grateful for receiving the information so that it helps us to understand it better. But I don't think we'll be able to come with quick fix solutions. You see, this is a problem, this is a solution, because it's an ever-changing challenge. Now, Chair, I noticed that the information that we have been presented with is relying mostly on the statistics that were conducted by the Statistics South Africa from 2001 to 2011. I think the base statistics that we are using now is the 2011 one. I wonder if either the department or any of the presenters, they've studied the developments that are happening in the town called Lephala. Because when I look at this information on the population increase, both from SSA and from some of the information from CSIR, I don't see any mention of that particular area. That is very important, because that area is going to be one of the post post-apartheid, you know, kind of town that's going to be emerging in this new administration. So I wonder if we have been able to study the patterns there and the requirements for us to do proper planning from the infrastructure point of view and so forth. Because that might have happened in the past 4 years, from 2012 up to today. There are rapid developments that are taking place in that part of the area, which might serve as an example for other future urban developments throughout the country. Thanks.
Okay, I'm sure I know the point. So the situation on the ground is not static. A place that used to be called LSS, which is now called Lephala, is developing at a very, very fast rate. There are many things that are happening there. There are deposits of coal that will last over 100 years and so on. So there are all kinds of situations that we need to study very, very, very well. But also, in order not to be lost into the detail, we do need a high-level summary of some of these issues so that our discussions remain really very focused. Otherwise, we can be all over the show and end up not doing anything at all. I think both Milhan and Phil are pointing us in the same kind of direction in relation to future discussions. And therefore, the preparation that must go into laying a basis for the discussion that we should have at a committee such as this. Yes, there we are. But are there any other comments? I'm sure the points are being noted. Let's see if anybody else wants to speak. Just start with yourself. Yeah, let's start with yourself. Yeah.
very much. Yeah. Chair, I don't know if Deputy Minister Nell or the department has shared with the portfolio committee the fact that South Africa has chosen to host AfriCities, Chair, which is a conference, a summit of all African municipalities held under the auspices of the UCLGA. And the way in which we have conceptualized the conference, Chair, just to share with the committee, is that we intend that there be a peer review of a sample, a relatively good sample of South African municipalities, where colleagues from outside of the country will be given the space to engage with South African municipalities and try to understand whether in the last 15 years of local government have we achieved or have we not achieved, including punching holes into some of our policy imperatives, the IUDF, the disaster management. So there's a whole menu of issues to be discussed with our counterparts from across the continent. And I'm sure if that has not been relayed to the committee, I'm sure Deputy Minister Nell will find the opportunity. But I thought, let me raise that, because I think what political leadership at local government is saying is that we shouldn't be afraid of being peer reviewed. Otherwise, we shall not grow, and all the issues that have been raised here will certainly come up. I thought I should just say that, Chair.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I think we have on previous occasion raised the issue of the AfriCities conference with the portfolio committee. I think the minister also raised it in his budget in the recent budget debate. But I think it is going to be a landmark event, and I think it would be well worth the portfolio committee maybe putting it on its agenda for some more substantive. Maybe also closer to the time. I think the comments made by the members we've taken, I think they're very good comments. They point us the way forward. Maybe just to say that as part of the policy work that's being done on the integrated urban development framework, we've also said that following that good understanding that theory should guide practice and practice should enrich theory, that even as we are engaged in the policy process, we should be moving out and getting our hands a little bit dirtier. And the department has already done some work around selecting potential pilot site. That point was also made very strongly in the last political oversight committee meeting that we had. We're saying let's maybe take a range of cross sections. We also don't want too many because it becomes unmanageable and all that. But maybe take Lepalade, take maybe a bigger established urban area, maybe take one or two mid-sized very urban area, maybe some high density area within the rural area, and go in and do much more detailed research work. Start testing those things that we're writing about. Not that these things are not informed by practice. So I think that is a good suggestion that's already being taken care of. Chairperson, maybe just in conclusion, to say with your permission, either before you formally close the meeting or maybe just after you do. The other day I came across a very interesting video clip, very, very short, just around the bibliographic illustration of a number of cities across the world, including Germany. I think it's quite instructive to see how that works. If you're happy for that to be shown.
I'm sure I can do that. Ready.
I guess we're at the point now, colleagues, where we can say that we should note the discussions that we've had and express an idea that we see these issues being dealt with much, much more in a focused manner in future. And that we should look at what we have discussed here, crystallize it, and then ensure that real high quality, high level summaries of some of the issues are presented, so that this kind of discussion can be meaningful. As we have already indicated, issues such as climate change, migration and then disaster management are issues that in themselves not that's a matter that's been discussed in Africa knows. A matter that is discussed globally. And need to ensure that our discussion has fairly thorough and that when we do put these matters in front of Parliament at some date in future, not far away, we do so in a way that really empowers and limits the ongoing debate in South Africa. Of course, we do note as well that some of the departments, such as the Environment Department and so on, have been dealing with some of the matters for a longer time. Knows that the cities, the preparations and so on, and how some of that work are speaking in the way that we are doing in an ongoing manner. Other colleagues, we should end the meeting, I think, on that note. But before we close the meeting, let's find out if the chairperson wants to say.